Good morning. It's Thursday, August 11th. We reach the show 715-388-7155, or you can email us radio at upnorthnewswi.com. Very happy to be joined by State Representative Evan Goyke from Milwaukee. And we're going to spend this time talking about the legislature, legislative matters, and legislative races that will be, you know, coming up over these next 90 days. Evan, good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
As I did with Congressman Pocan in our previous hour, though, I think one of the more noteworthy things in terms of, you know, Wisconsin, not just its politics, but frankly, how taxpayer money is being used, is this very public breakup between Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and the investigator, quote unquote, that he hired, former Supreme Court Justice Mike Gabelman. So that primary that Voss faced, and what was that, a 260 vote margin? Did you see that coming?
I knew he was in trouble a week ago. The scuttle on the inside, that some of the outside groups that supported the speaker had been doing some polling, and his numbers were consistently going down, or the race was narrowing and narrowing. But I got to tell you and be honest, I did not think it would be that close. And it is an incredible loss for the speaker. Obviously, Voss won the election. He's the Republican nominee in a gerrymandered Republican district, so he's likely to be reelected. But for the longest serving speaker and the individual that really runs the Republican Party in the entire state of Wisconsin, to come that close against somebody that kind of came out of obscurity is really... it can't be understated how big of a hit Voss took. We don't know the final numbers now, Pat, but it's what I've heard through the grapevines is the speaker and his allies spent about $500,000 on his own reelection, all told. He got about 5,000 votes, about $100 per vote. So not only did he come close to losing, but he went all in. Yeah, all the chips were in. Some of the folks that normally support Republicans went all in as well. And that whole machine and all of the might of that machine was almost taken down by Trump and his Twitter and an outside candidate in Gabelman. So it's really, it can't be understated just how incredible that whole soap opera was.
So then the question becomes, because the old saying is if you aim for the king, you best not miss. Does Voss come out of this, you know, stronger and more determined because you didn't take him down? Or is he now damaged goods and goes into that potential caucus next week, maybe with his job less secure than he'd like to think?
It's certainly less secure than he'd like to think. It's less secure than he thought it would be. Keep in mind, he was also a strong Clayfish supporter, as were most incumbent Republican legislators. So I don't know that my wife would okay this, but I would pay a healthy amount of money to be a fly on the wall of that Republican caucus where Janelle Branchon and Robin Voss do trust falls to try to get on the same team to back Tim Michaels. It will be painfully awkward room. My prediction personally is that Voss walks away before he's ousted. He's been at this for a long time. He has a lot of achievements that we all have spent a lot of time and energy trying to defeat. I don't think he's got anything left to prove. And if I were in his shoes, I would say, have it. I'm out of here. In the caucuses, Pat, in the trenches, in order for Voss not to be speaker, somebody else has to run for speaker. And the challenge of replacing Voss has always been, it's not that people in that caucus don't like, there are a number of Republican assembly members that would love to see Robin gone as speaker, but none of them want to raise their hand and be the candidate. So at this point, I don't know of anybody that's mounting a campaign against Voss for speaker, but it could happen. The last thing I'll say on this topic is the speaker and his campaign machine were behind a number of candidates in open seats. We have a tremendous number of legislative retirements this year. And the speaker did not win all of those. So there are a number of people in the Republican primaries advancing that are coming, going forward to the general with a sour taste in their mouth towards the speaker. And that will further erode his power in the caucus.
Assembly State Representative Evan Goyke is joining us and demonstrating the real difference between the Assembly over in the West Wing of the state Capitol and those of us who are in the state Senate down in the South Wing of the Capitol, because you're talking about people in a caucus that, you know, aren't jockeying to be speaker or majority leader. And I will tell you that in the Senate Democratic caucus, there were 18 of us senators in the room, and there's no doubt all 18 thought they should be majority leader. And we're quite willing, if the opportunity presented itself, to do that. But that's what they in the Capitol call senitude.
And yes, lucky to have survived, Pat.
Oh, don't I know it.
Senitude is real. Sorry, all my friends in the Senate.
No, it is. And you know what? Some of us wear it like a badge of honor. So that's how we're going to roll with the rest of this interview. Evan Goyke is our guest. We will be taking a break shortly. When we come back, we will talk a bit more about the Gableman, quote unquote, investigation, its cost to taxpayers, what it has done to, his constituents, faith in democracy, frankly, a bit more about the legislative races that he's watching and, Tony Evers looking for a second term. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Up North News. Morning. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitler. We're joined with State Representative Evan Goyke and looking ahead to the fall campaign now that we've had the primary election this week. But before we do, we were talking about the alleged investigation by Michael Gableman into the 2020 presidential election. In light of the comments made both by Voss and by Gableman, especially Gableman's robocall on behalf of Voss's opponent, saying that Voss never wanted, quote unquote, a real investigation, it prompted several of your colleagues, Evan, to ask the Legislative Audit Committee to conduct a formal audit of the Gableman operation and see if this actually, this $1.25 million or something like that of taxpayer funds has in fact been used on an investigation, or if it has been a massive waste that has not and was never intended to have a real purpose. What were your thoughts seeing that some of your colleagues asked for that audit?
Well, let me start by saying it is refreshing to hear Mr. Gableman say his investigation was not real. Let's believe him when he says he didn't actually do a real investigation. Trust the source. I think an audit is totally appropriate. Let's not lose track of the fact that these are public funds. We're well over $1 million. The Republicans have often crowed about auditing certain programs in state government, social safety net programs, ensuring that public dollars are spent as efficiently and effectively as possible. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Let's do it. Bring out the accountants and the spreadsheets and the calculators and red markers, and let's find out what they really spent money on. And, there have been some lawsuits over the lack of transparency and the lack of record keeping. I expect we will find additional problems with or violations of record retention and open meetings, and it's going to be wrought with problems, but let's get to the bottom of it. So I wholly support the audit. I think I know what the outcome of that will be, that this was a total waste of money, and it's been embarrassing. It's a historical note in the state's history that really is just a black eye. And it is, the irony of it coming back on Voss when it was his creation is just, it's
poetic.
It's poetic. Yeah. And let me tell you from the trenches, one of the things I can offer listeners is what it's like to be a state representative. Let me tell you, I talked to my Republican colleagues quite a bit. They weren't excited about this. This was all about appeasing a certain small fringe vocal minority of the Republican base, although larger than many people thought, you know, appeasing Trump. And lo and behold, it backfired. And it was a total mistake from the beginning. Robin Voss is a real tactful politician. He usually has things buttoned up pretty tightly. He's pretty disciplined. He's not a dumb guy. This was one of the dumbest mistakes that, you know, he has ever made in his career. And he knows it. And I think that contract with Mr. Gabelman is going to get ripped up any day now. I'd be surprised. I thought first thing Wednesday morning after Voss squeaked by was goodbye, Gabelman.
I think so. Now, again, as I've speculated, what if Voss is in for a surprise and it turns out more of his caucus is actually, you know, pro Gabelman, Trump, you know, what have you? I doubt it. I think Voss knows how to count the votes. But, you know, in this environment, can we ever really say?
Well, our first segment, Pat, we talked about Voss squeaking by and the amount of resources it took to keep him through to the next round. Well, if you're kind of a newer or more of a backbencher representative, and you see that outcome, and you know you don't have $500,000 of firepower behind you, you look at that outcome and say, "Oh boy, I got to appease this base. I don't like Gabelman, but." I actually think it digs in a number of the incumbent Republicans a bit because they're very fearful of the base and of President Trump's Twitter.
So when Speaker Voss later yesterday walked back the way that he referred to Michael Gabelman as an embarrassment and said, well, he was just talking about a particular facet of the investigation, I immediately tweeted out something like, well, I reset the board. We're back to just Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger as the only elected Republicans willing to tell the Trump and the Trump people to pound sand. And I think we're back at that. I think specifically here in the Senate district where I served, Kathy Bernier is the Republican serving here now and was one of those very few people willing to say, especially given that she was a former county clerk herself, she'd say in so many words, hey, you dummies. This is all made up. This is all a lie. But, you know, she's retiring. You mentioned the record number of retirements. I know that you answering this question might put the pressure on somebody, but does anybody in the Republican caucus, assembly or Senate strike you as the one who's going to be the next, you know, take over for Kathy Bernier, take over for Liz Cheney and you know, speak the truth?
No. The only real person that might actually do that would be Voss himself. But the outcome of primaries across the state on Tuesday is really a warning shot to Republicans. The losers Tuesday night were the moderate Republicans. Their primaries largely went to the right, to the conservative, right? I mean, look, you know, you can start at the Michaels vote. The attorney general vote was a little split, but if you put Jarkow and Mueller together, that block was much larger than a more traditional Eric Toney, who ended up winning because of the split vote. But then in primaries, like Pat, in your area, you know, Representative Jesse James, a former police chief, you know, not a firebrand in the assembly. I mean, he went through to the next round, but it was close for a long time. And the, you know, more conservative, more outspoken candidate really made it very, very close with much fewer resources and less in institutional support. So I think Tuesday's outcome for Republicans down around the state, down ballot, like in the state assembly, is you better not speak out against the Gabelman investigation. You better fall in line and believe the big lie and peddle it loudly.
Well, nobody has to drive far around their district across rural Wisconsin, especially without seeing, you know, still a Trump flag or some variation of it. So the symbols are very much out there. And you have a legislature that is solidly in Republican control purely by gerrymandering. If you did it just on a statewide vote total, you know, the legislature would be slightly Democratic, but the maps are rigged the way that they are. So it leads to this question as we pivot to the fall campaign. I'm not looking for an exact number because that puts, you know, pressure on certain candidates and campaigns. But I mean, how many competitive races are there really in maps like this? Are there many, or are there just a couple that you look at and say, well, there's where we could conceivably have a pickup?
Yeah, I think, Pat, you've nailed it. These new re-gerrymandered, they're actually worse gerrymandered than the last decade, has limited the number of competitive seats. And just so, you know, one thing to note is, as I have been going door to door in my own district, which changed pretty substantially, there are a host of Wisconsinites that don't know they're in a new district, right? They don't, this will be the first election with a new number, you know, potentially a new polling place. This will be the first test run of these, of this new gerrymander. I'll break this into two populations. There are critical incumbents to retain on the Democratic side. Seats in the Assembly and Senate on the shores of Lake Superior in the far north, candidates through the central Wisconsin River Valley, like Katrina Shanklin, to the west, like Steve Doyle in the Assembly. And then in your neck of the woods, Senator Jeff Smith. And so then those are kind of the retaining quality, good, strong Democrats that have districts that are more purple. And then pick up opportunities. The kind of tip of the spear has been, and I think this year will continue to be, the suburbs of Metro Milwaukee. So there's a new assembly district in the southwest corner of Milwaukee County, the 84th, where the Democratic candidate Lou Ann Bird will face off with former Milwaukee Alderman Bob Donovan. You have the 5th Senate district, where the Democratic candidate Jess Katzenmeyer will face off against former Representative Rob Hutton in the western suburbs. So those are going to be very close. So there are a couple of other, you know, the South Milwaukee and Oak Creek district in the 21st Assembly, the Fox Valley in the Senate, I think, in the former Roth seat will be very, 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 very close. So there are opportunities to pick up seats, but they're not very many. And they fall into those retain the incumbents, save the governor's veto, and then some pickup opportunities around the state.
And further complicating that in every election cycle is you know, that you're down ballot. The legislative races are down ballot. There's always something up there, you know, presidential year, a gubernatorial, this year U.S. Senate as well as gubernatorial. So it's not necessarily a fair question, but I'll ask that in, by and large, on legislative races in Wisconsin this year, how much of a factor do you think it will be? Just a factor of national trends, meaning Trump, you know, his supporters. How much of it is more of a state level factor, like the coattails from a Tony Evers and a Mandela Barnes, versus, you know, actual local issues that, you know, determine these races? You know, what is the strategy that candidates bring into a legislative race when you have so much noise at the top of the ticket?
Yeah, Pat, that's a great question. We don't take it personally that we're all the way down at the bottom of the ballot. We wear it as a badge of honor. Our politics on both sides of the aisle, in my opinion, have nationalized, where a tweet from a representative in Georgia or Washington or New York is, you know, becomes viral. And now I'm a Democrat, so I believe what somebody else says in a different state, or they're Republican, so they have to agree with. So it's harder to cut through the noise, but those local issues, that door knocking, the one-on-one contacts that, you know, like a legislative race really depends on, still are the bread and butter of winning elections. Door to door, talking to people, that's it.
I really have to agree with that. And I have to tip my cap to my staff, my campaign staff at the time, and my legislative staff prior to my attempt to run for reelection, was, you know, to really look and say, look, it's a big state Senate district, but in these communities, if you spend extra time knocking on doors, meeting people there, you're going to build, you know, your numbers. And the fact of the matter is, it was true in these two particular communities. I mean, I worked them hard, and we gained seats. But, you know, 2010 was also the year of the Tea Party, and so ultimately that fell short. But it's just more to your point that it is still, you know, there's still grassroots politicking to be done at the local level, and not everybody, but many people still appreciate that.
Yeah, and enough people to change an election outcome. So that's the bread and butter.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with State Representative Evan Goyke about legislative races and, you know, the makeup of the legislature. And we've got less than a minute before we go to break. So probably we'll come back to this. But I can't help but note the Republicans put you and the rest of the legislature on a 10-month vacation. So what'd you do on your vacation? Are you enjoying it?
I wish we were more active. I've got lots of good ideas to solve problems, help constituents. I had a baby, or my wife had a baby, so that's been keeping me personally busy. But no, let's talk about.
You really should have led with that, because there's no vacation for you anytime soon. Evan Goyke is our guest. We'll take a break and be back with more after this. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Good morning. This is Up North News. Luke is staffing the turntable here, and every so often you have to put the needle down a second time. Have you ever actually played an actual player where you put the needle on a piece of vinyl? No?
Like maybe once.
Wow.
Maybe once.
This hurts.
I don't need the ageism, all right? I'm young. Leave me be. I can't handle it.
Evan, they gave me a producer in his 20s. Is that fair to do to somebody who's chasing 60 on the horizon here?
Nah, Pat, I feel you, though. I have young staff that, all they do is Google Docs and things I don't understand. It's hard. Change is hard.
Yeah, and look, they've turned me into that guy. I didn't want to be the get-off-my-lawn guy, but this is what
inevitable.
We've come to.
It's inevitable.
We are talking with Representative Goyke about legislative races and legislative matters. And I did want to ask one more. It's a little inside baseball on campaigning, but this is going to be an inside baseball show, folks. So get used to it. I remember, especially when Howard Dean was running for president back in the day and talking about the 50-state strategy and don't leave any states off the table simply because, they're traditionally red states. You got to fight everywhere. So there's a lot of people that have said at the state level, that for the assembly where there's 99 seats in the Senate, there's 33. So in the assembly, it's like we should have a 99 district strategy and have 99 candidates. And I would argue that that's a nice thing to have. But, resources are much more finite at the state level. So there are not 99 Democratic candidates, but perhaps you disagree and think that you should be playing in every district, no matter how gerrymandered and red it is.
Yeah, and we do try. I mean, there is no, I've been in the assembly for 10 years now. That's 5 election cycles. And every single one of those, we've tried to fill out Democratic candidates in every single district we can. And the Republicans do too. I have a constituent that called me and said, hey, I got a call from Republican staffer saying I should run against you as a Republican in a heavily Democratic seat, but that they would help. So both sides do this. And there's, I think, some wisdom to it. I think it helps to have candidates all the way down ballot. We had in our last segment the power of one-on-one communication at people's doors. So I think this year we have well over 80 contested or 80 Democrats running of the 99. So and that includes deep red seats where, proud Democrats have put their name on the ballot. The outcomes from that are incredibly important. And let me give you an example. The western suburbs near me in Milwaukee, in 2012, the year I got elected, we had 2 Dems running and they got absolutely trounced. This is a gerrymandered district, 60-40 GOP win. But we were able to see, because they ran, some cracks in that gerrymander in various neighborhoods of some of the inner suburbs. And that's where the organizing took place the next year and the next year and the next year. We flipped red to blue in 18, one of those seats. We flipped the other one in 2020. So having Dems on the ballot, really helps provide data and an understanding of what that community is. Pat, you shared the story of going to certain communities within your Senate district. So the only way you know what's going on the ground is to be on the ground. And to do that in the legislative races, you need a candidate.
And the more, the other thing it does is, of course, every extra voter that's motivated helps the top of the ticket, so that if Tony Evers, wins by 3 votes, every state rep is going to, or every candidate is going to say, well, yeah, it was the 3 cousins that voted for me, because I decided to run in Waukesha County. They wouldn't have voted anyway.
But yeah, that's right. That's right. They felt a bit disenfranchised. They hadn't seen a Dem show up for a while. I was brave to go to the end of the cul-de-sac and knock that door. And lo and behold, four votes came out. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
The margin, you know, it doesn't matter what part of the state, it's still the margin. Representative Evan Goyke is talking with us and talking about Governor Evers running for re-election. He obviously has some issues and points and even achievements that he wants to run on. The Lincoln Hills Juvenile Detention Facility has, you know, been a blight on Wisconsin for a number of years. It is well behind any kind of court order to close and put a better model in place. But there is finally some progress being made on that front.
Yeah. So this has been one of the most important issues I've worked on in my career. And actually, the legislature has come together and passed legislation to bring the facility in Lincoln County to a close. We've gotten snagged on funding the correct network of replacement facilities. You can't just go and close that facility without a better place to put those kids, right? The point of this endeavor is to improve juvenile justice in Wisconsin, not just close one facility and open another just like it. And so the progress that has been made on Tuesday, Governor Evers and the Department of Corrections under his leadership announced arriving at a location in Milwaukee. It's likely that the city council in Milwaukee will vote in favor of that tomorrow. That's required under state law for this particular project. And then it's up to the Joint Committee on Finance to help a couple of county projects go forward. And it is possible that a week or so from now, we could have in place all of those additional facilities that would bring Lincoln Hills to a close. And it's a increased mental health, increased local county-run facilities, and a new modernized.
I think we've got a freeze on Representative Goyke, unless it's a freeze on me, which is always a possibility.
This would really catch us up to the rest of the country and what folks are doing.
Okay. My apologies, folks, if you heard any kind of a glitch. I'm going to assume it was from way up here in Chippewa Falls and not Milwaukee, but we're back on the same page together here as well. So in terms of getting things done, that's one thing that, you know, the governor is going to point to in his reelection effort. I think the other, though, is just the way that he has put federal aid to work, pandemic relief, in so many different ways. Now, this obviously has been rubbing Republicans in the legislature the wrong way, that you know, this federal relief package authority was given exclusively to governors in the state. And not every governor has used it the same way, but Governor Evers is getting a lot of praise for the various ways that he is putting that relief into the state economy in so many different areas. Which ones do you particularly point to and say there's something we got done that wouldn't have gotten done if we were solely dependent on a Republican-controlled budget?
So I think the governor's had a laser focus on small businesses and helping entities that were cut off from their normal business model during COVID. It's just really incredible just what he, the Department of Administration, the WEDC, they just really focused on mitigating the economic impact. And that's why we have a big surplus in part and why we had as little economic disruption as possible. One comment I wanted to make, Pat, you know, the Republicans, you're hearing all of Ron Johnson's ads about reckless federal spending and that's behind inflation. And you're going to hear legislative Republicans say the same garbage. I just want to remind listeners that Republicans introduced bills to spend more than the federal money than we had. They couldn't make up their mind. They wanted to spend it. They spent it twice. Almost two times as much federal aid as was actually given to Wisconsin, the Republicans tried to spend in various different bills. So we were very, very fortunate to have Governor Evers. Look, I mean, I think he had programs that targeted rural Wisconsin and farming communities, and he had initiatives that targeted my urban neck of the woods and housing, you know, keeping people in their homes. I mean, it's pretty incredible just how robust and thorough his federal relief aid was spread around the state. We're lucky to have it.
And it was not the federal relief aid was not intended to be a substitute for state spending and state investments. It was meant to be a supplement, a replacement where possible because of, dire economic conditions. But it leads me to that state budget surplus. There was a decent size surplus projected before COVID hit. And then, of course, the bottom fell out from the economy. Then the recovery has happened, managed differently in every state. But again, because of what Governor Evers has done, we've been doing that well enough that we have not just a healthy surplus. We have a large budget surplus here that could be put to work in so many ways. Doesn't have to be necessarily new spending. It can be making areas. But Republicans won't do that. They're sitting on billions of dollars until next January, when I firmly believe the correct word for this is a heist. We are in the middle of a heist from taxpayers who don't know it yet, but they are this close to having about $5 billion taken from them. They'll get some of it back, but by and large, it will be put in the form of tax cuts geared toward the wealthy. That's certainly my thought, that's what's at play here, what's at risk, especially if Evers loses. How do you see the surplus that remains behind lock and key in the Republican caucus?
Yeah, I think you're right, Pat. Two areas of major focus for me, and I think many of my colleagues, will be our public school system. This current state budget, under the guise that federal aid came to public school districts, Republicans underfunded. You made the correct point earlier. The federal aid wasn't meant to be replacement of state aid, and that's exactly how Republicans treated federal aid to public school districts. So huge, huge cracks coming to bear in public education funding, and part of this money really needs to go to catch districts up from the last year and a half. The UW system has been chronically underfunded for the last decade, received some major cuts and has had tuition freezes. And so, part of that, I think, part of that surplus really need to go to catch up, where we've been less and less competitive with our national peers. I think there's great, great danger in the Republicans going towards a flat tax or some kind of reduced progressivity in our income tax structure. A flat tax would increase taxes for working people living on the margins of poverty and decrease taxes substantially to those highest income earners. It would punch a hole in our future state budgets. My son is 14 months old. By the time he's graduating high school, we would still be reeling from the lost revenue and lost investment in public institutions if we go down that route.
One last topic that I want to hit before we run out of time here, and it's not an easy one for you, but I want to ask, how you think Democrats can handle this. And that's the whole, soft on crime notion, because you have in Governor Evers somebody who has paroled many people who have turned their lives around, has pardoned many people who have turned their lives around, proved to be a benefit to society. You just talked about Lincoln Hills and turning what was just straight up incarceration into actual treatment, mental health care, things like that. But it will mean, fewer juveniles are behind bars, and always the risk that, you get that one bad apple out there. So it leads to, obviously, what is going to be in Republican ads. It's already in Republican ads. How do you get that message out that treatment and reform is still better than just lock them up and throw away the key for everybody?
It's incredibly hard. And, crime is real. It's people are victimized, and we can't lose sight of that. So my first strategy is, let's not pretend that this isn't a serious issue or that people aren't hurt. And see and hear and recognize that victimization. But we have to uplift the stories, and there are stories that abound of people that have turned their life around. So locally in Milwaukee, I've done a lot of work with different organizations that they call it Correct the Narrative, where they kind of really do the hard work of highlighting how individuals that have been incarcerated have turned their life around and become law-abiding, productive citizens. We just need to continue to amplify those stories and invest in those programs that work.
Yeah. I mean, second chances are real, not just because you know somebody personally and can vouch for it. There's plenty of it around there. State Representative Evan Goyke, we talked during the break. Next time around, we'll play a game of music confessions where we, you know, reveal what's on our phones, our little guilty pleasure for songs. Think about that for next time. All right. But in the meantime, you've got enough to do just chasing the little guy around. So thanks for spending some time with us. Best of luck to you, and we'll talk again real soon.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We will wrap up this hour's conversation next. You're up north.
Soda, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
No, see, Luke, when you do that, people think I'm going to slide across in my tidy whities and do a little dance. And that's not.
I don't understand the reference. I'm too young.
Oh, stop.
I'm kidding. I know that one.
This is Up North News for all you old fellas out there. We were just talking with State Representative Evan Goyke, and we were talking in one area about mental health care. And we are doing more all the time. We are making progress in removing some of the stigma of it, of addressing the challenges and the needs, but it is slow in coming. And I wanted to single out one particular area where Governor Evers was using part of the funding from the American Rescue Plan. And our political analyst, Joe Zepecki, put up an article about it on our website sometime not too long ago and noted that Evers is directing $5 million to Children's Hospital Wisconsin for a pediatric mental health walk-in clinic and to establish a residency program for med students there. And then $14 million is going to go to UW-Whitewater to expand its training programs for aspiring mental health care workers. Just two of the many examples of where money's being put to work. You have to work with what you've got. And Governor Evers is working with what is in the American Rescue Plan, which, again, all it did was save the U.S. economy from a depression, you know, brought about by the COVID pandemic, despite no Republican votes, despite Republican efforts to either block it or send aid money to tax cuts. Again, the ridiculousness of, you know, Reagan-esque trickle-down thinking that just isn't going to happen. These are matters. These are serious matters. They take people who want to work for a living and not state legislators who are on vacation for 10 months now, won't be back until January of next year. And then we'll determine, you know, what to do with a budget surplus. And it may not be, you know, spent nearly as well as what American Rescue Plan funds are doing right now to be put to work. Brand new article at upnorthnewswi.com about how rural Wisconsin is still stuck with slowdowns and cutbacks at the U.S. Postal Service and how Senator Ron Johnson has not been helping with this for the past decade or so. And I write about Tina Pullman of La Crosse. She has a nonprofit that she started to help raise funds for medical research for an autoimmune disorder that she and others suffer from. Her nonprofit secretary is in California. And for the longest time, as needed, they used the United States Postal Service. And she said, if you put something in a two-day envelope, it's going to get to California in 2 days. Something comes from California, it's going to get there in 2 days. And it doesn't anymore. And she, you know, Tina holds people like Ron Johnson responsible. She says, quote, "He's not looking out for small businesses like mine. He's not looking out for smaller and mid-level businesses that use the U.S. Postal Service on a regular basis." This is somebody that in her work, and look, the Postal Service gets used for lots of things. In rural Wisconsin, rural America, people send baby chicks, you know, and bees and, you know, all kinds of, you know, living things, you know, plants, what have you, not to mention foodstuffs. It's not just bills, but the bills are important too. The paperwork is important too. And, you know, Tina, every year, like every nonprofit, has to apply for permission on a state-by-state basis for the, you know, the licensing to be a fundraiser. to raise money for this nonprofit. And that involves, you know, a lot of mail, which had been going swimmingly until Louis DeJoy, Donald Trump's choice to run the U.S. Postal Service, came along and exacerbated problems that were actually put on the U.S. Postal Service by Republicans back in 2006, 2007. Now, this was all in the name of the U.S. Postal Service was, you know, quote unquote, losing money, wasn't turning a profit. Question for you. Does anybody ask, why hasn't the Army made money? Why aren't the Marines turning a profit? No, we don't do that. We don't do that about virtually anything else because it's a government service. When you get involved in serving the people, that is not, again, it's that whole notion of run government like a business, which is should be your number one red flag that somebody is not equipped to engage in public service. But as a result of that mindset, you had Republicans who insisted that the U.S. Postal Service had to prepay for its health costs for future retirees, not people who've retired yet, may not retire for decades, but the Postal Service has to prepay for those health benefits. It obviously put billions and billions and billions of liability, you know, on its spreadsheet that it couldn't overcome. And, you know, Ron Johnson 10 years ago was among those who said, nope, we can't help you. You know, this is your burden. Maybe we should just, you know, privatize everything. And in fact, that's what Tina and many others have had to do after a lifetime of using the Postal Service personally and years or decades from their small business. They have had to use the more expensive private carriers, FedEx and UPS and DHL and all of that. And so finally, there was a reform bill that passed this year, and the Postal Service Reform Act was passed. It was signed by President Biden in April to help the USPS get out from under all that red tape. And you know, remember, Ron Johnson's all about getting rid of the red tape if it's in the private sector. But again, Johnson opposed it. Biden has signed it. Perhaps the damage has already been done for businesses, you know, in rural Wisconsin. And so, you know, Tina had said that I was pretty disgusted that he voted no. I mean, he pays a lot of lip service to us, but he says one thing and does another. I'm a businesswoman, and he's not looking out for small businesses like mine. And he's referring to somebody who, you know, again, rejected repeated pleas for help. And yet then years later said, well, the Postal Service problems have been building for years and somebody should have done something about them. But he was there and he did not. And instead of removing the artificial $50 billion liability, Johnson was suggesting rolling back overtime pay for mail carriers, you know, things like that. And so you now have, oh, by the way, it's not just, you know, small business people. It's not just farmers, veterans had to deal with delays in receiving their prescription medications. And the VA, in many instances, again, had to use those more expensive carriers that cost the taxpayers money. And by the way, they do one other thing. By taking that business away from the Postal Service, it only exacerbates their financial problems. So what we need is a U.S. Postal Service that is supported properly, supported as well as we support other functions for the people, is allowed to be, you know, creative, provide better service, provide more services to people, because they will serve the communities. They have to serve the communities that the big boys don't have to serve and don't have to serve affordably. So look for that story at upnorthnewswi.com and in our newsletter. Angela Lang from Block, when we come back, you're up north.